Good morning. I'm Pastor Joel. As we all continue to figure out how to navigate these uncharted waters during the COVID-19 pandemic, the members of Namakagan Congregational UCC in Earle continue to practice social distancing, and we limit our gathering for our safety and our community's safety. While we continue to worship together on Zoom, we also broadcast our message here on Muskie 101 every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. so those without computers or high-speed internet can join us. This morning's scripture reading comes from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 14. Now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a deserted place by himself. But when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion for them and cured their sick. When it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and the hour is now late. Send the crowds away so they may go into the villages and buy food for themselves." Jesus said to them, "They need not go away. You give them something to eat." They replied, "We have nothing here but 5 loaves and 2 fish. And he said, "Bring them here to me." Then he ordered the crowds to sit down in the grass. Taking the 5 loaves and 2 fish, he looked up to the heaven, blessed and broke the loaves, and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. And all ate and were filled. And they took up what was left over of broken pieces, 12 baskets full. And those who ate were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. Food and the sharing of it are powerful in so many ways, in feeding our bodies, but also symbolically in feeding and nourishing our spirits. Isn't the offering and sharing of food, whatever food we have, at the heart of hospitality, just as much as offering shelter, or just as much as inviting someone in? And don't we feel nourished in more ways than one if we eat our food in the company of others? That's one of the difficult parts of this pandemic, is it's not easy for us to safely share a meal with those whom we love or work with, or those we would like to get to know better. Sharing food satisfies a basic human need in more ways than one. All 4 gospel writers tell this story in their gospels about Jesus meeting our most basic human needs, our deepest hungers, feeding the hungry, not just ourselves, but a hungry world, is also at the core of the gospel. What did you do in the face of human hunger? First, as we set the scene, things have not been going well in Jesus' ministry. So he had to teach in parables. That way, the insiders, his followers who have ears, will know what he's saying, and the powerful outsiders will not. But in his hometown, even his own people took offense to him. And then Jesus received the bad news that John the Baptist had been murdered by Herod. A certain tension arises between the two meals. On one hand, Herod, the guilty, has thrown a big birthday party for himself, a feast for his buddies, ending with the murdered John's head served on a platter. That meal is marked by a lot of bad things, including this desire for blood, and it unfolds into this horrific murder of a great man. Even Herod knows that this was grieved. Food was there, and friends, yet this meal was not a blessed meal. On the other hand, as Jesus withdraws to a deserted place, the scene is set for a very different meal with different hungers fed and a very different experience of power and of community. Both Herod and Jesus give commands, but one set of commands is death-dealing and the other is life-sustaining. What draws people into the company of a man like Herod? And what draws them into the company of a man like Jesus. Herod sits in a palace with guards and a prison below him, and Jesus stands on a deserted hillside, far from the seat of one kind of power, but right at the heart of a much greater power. Because Herod feels threatened by Jesus, or at least by these powers at work in him, he becomes an even greater threat to Jesus. Fear is a most dangerous thing, and Herod is motivated by fear, just as Jesus is moved by compassion. Perhaps Jesus' own needs were very different from those of the crowd. With John dead, perhaps he thought it would be wise to flee to a remote place. No one knows for sure, but we can be fairly certain that Jesus' own heart must have been broken. Barbara Brown Taylor says that Jesus has lost his prophet, and that the crowd has undoubtedly heard the news too. Sometimes, after very bad news, it does not matter what you eat as long as you eat it with someone. Perhaps in that deserted place, now filled with a crowd, they were all able to draw strength and consolation from being together and looking to Jesus with hope and longing and sharing a meal together. And as is customary, Jesus disregards his own needs, and he goes to work, fueled by compassion at the sight of the sick people gathered around him. The story is so familiar that I think sometimes we pass this scene by, or perhaps we're distracted by trying to figure out how to explain the nature of the miracles that he performed. How did that happen? Did bread and fishes suddenly materialize, or did lots of folks reach into their pockets and bags and share with one another? Can miracles really be explained? How did it feel to be the people in the crowd itself, and how would it have felt to leave my village behind, my home, in the market where I might be able to buy food? At least we would have company with others. People presumably a lot like ourselves, people in need, people moved by hunger, spiritually, as much as physically. As we try to figure out how that must have felt, a few chapters back in this gospel, Jesus asks the question, What did you go out into the wilderness to see? So we might wonder what would draw us into a deserted place, and what we most want to see, to feel, to touch. What do we hunger for the most? What would draw us out of our comfort zone? What indeed are our deepest needs, not our wants, but our needs? Even today, we remember the story of manna from heaven. And as Christians, we gather at the table and remember what Jesus did with bread on that hillside. The words used by Matthew here are familiar from the Last Supper account and from our own celebration of the Eucharist as well. The verbs take, bless, break, and give are simple but powerful and apply to our lives just as they apply to the bread we share with one another in the world. In fact, the work of the church goes on in every age and every wilderness, for the church is always in the desert, according to Thomas Long. The place where it cannot rely upon is its own resources, which are few. The church is hungry itself and is surrounded by a world of deep cravings. Long's description of the church's resources as few is thought-provoking for those who embrace a theology of abundance. Most folks and churches, pastors and lay members alike, would say that their church needs more money, more members, more help. And our perception is one of scarcity, even when we truly desire to act compassionately. The disciples around Jesus could have been motivated by compassion when they urged him to send the people into the villages for food. More important than how the miracle worked is the why, of course. Jesus' deep compassion for the suffering of the people and his response. The what for us is the command to go and do likewise. But how can we do likewise if there isn't enough to go around? And that gets to the deeper reality of abundance under the appearances of not enough. Barbara Brown Taylor says that where the disciples saw scarcity, Jesus operated under a different set of assumptions. Jesus knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that wherever there was plenty of God, there would be plenty of everything else. We know from Genesis and the story of creation and our observation of nature that God has provided far more than we need to survive, but we have failed to share generously. Instead, we have too often hoarded and held back. Still, abundance is there, and somewhere deep down, so is the generosity. We take a look at our ICU nurses and doctors and those who don't have enough personal protective equipment as they care for COVID-19 patients. And we are humbled and we should be awed by their expression of deep commitment to provide whatever care they can for those who are sick. Instead of shrinking in the face of scarcity, they exhibit an incredible generosity of spirit. Hundreds and hundreds of healthcare workers have given their life in trying to care for COVID-19 patients. But what about this idea that we are to let God do it all? The problem with miracles is that they mesmerize us and they lead us to leave everything up to God. Miracles let us off the hook. They appeal to the part of us that is all too happy to let God feed the crowd, to save the world, to do it all. Are we really disciples of Jesus, following in his ways, responding as we believe he would respond to the need around us? Our response is indeed a matter of discipleship, which is not merely a matter of managing limited resources. It is a matter of giving what we have in faith, in hope, and love, in acts of worship. And so, things aren't going to happen unless we participate. God tells us to stop waiting for food to fall from the sky and share what you have. Stop waiting for a miracle and participate in one instead. Bread, a simple and most necessary thing, both physically and spiritually, is indeed a powerful thing, and the sharing of it is at the heart of our life together in the church. I was hoping that today's sermon, I'd be able to share and connect with the scripture, with the beauty that I experienced in the Boundary Waters last week. And at first, I immediately thought about the fish multiplying and the bread multiplying. You see, my dad does most of the planning and the packing of the food and menu for this trip. And after a day of the most humid conditions of portaging and canoeing into the Boundary Waters, we were all looking forward to the juicy grilled burgers that he had packed with the thinly sliced fresh fried potatoes. And then he realized he forgot to pack the beef. And it was fine. We had plenty of food with us. But it just meant that we were going to have to catch a little bit more fish than we had planned on for our dinners for the following week. And while fishing was not so good for most of us, my dad was able to catch the next day a fish of a lifetime, a nice fat 28-inch walleye, into the canoe. And he was able to feed all of us with this one fish. And I wanted to use that story in this sermon. But as I returned back to reality, the reality that is our life today, As I watched and listened to the words of the eulogies of John Lewis this week, I was humbled, and I made this connection with today's sermon, today's scripture. In the life that John Lewis led for all of us, selfless, always there to help in times of scarcity and in times of plenty. And then I read his final words, some of his final words that he wrote in an essay to be published on the day of his funeral. And I want to make sure that if you are listening, you have had the opportunity to hear the final words of a man who lived out the message of today's scripture in almost every single day of his life until the very end. And so to end today's message, I cannot find a better fitting end than to read John Lewis's final words to anyone who will listen. He wrote, "While my time here has now come to an end, I want you to know that in the last days and hours of my life, you inspired me. You filled me with hope about the next chapter of the great American story when you used your power to make a difference in our society. Millions of people motivated simply by human compassion laid down the burdens of division. Around the country and the world, you set aside race, class, age, language, and nationality to demand respect for human dignity. That is why I had to visit Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington, though I was admitted to the hospital the following day. I just had to see and feel it for myself that after many years of silent witness, and the truth is still marching on. Emmett Till was my George Floyd. He was my Richard Brooks, Sandra Bland, and Breonna Taylor. He was 14 when he was killed, and I was only 15 years old at the time. I will never, ever forget the moment when it became so clear that he could easily have been me. In those days, fear constrained us like an imaginary prison, and troubling thoughts of potential brutality committed for no understandable reason were the bars. Though I was surrounded by two loving parents, plenty of brothers, sisters, and cousins, their love could not protect me from the unholy oppression waiting just outside that family circle. Unchecked, unrestrained violence and government-sanctioned terror had the power to turn a simple stroll to the store for some Skittles or an innocent morning jog down a lonesome country road into a nightmare. If we are to survive as one unified nation, we must discover what so readily takes root in our hearts that could rob Mother Emanuel Church in South Carolina of her brightest and best, shoot unwitting concertgoers in Las Vegas, and choke to death the hopes and dreams of a gifted violinist like Elijah McClain. Like so many young people today, I was searching for a way out, or some might say a way in. And then I heard the voice of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on an old radio. He was talking about the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. He said we are all complicit when we tolerate injustice. He said it is not enough to say it will get better by and by. He said each of us has a moral obligation to stand up, and speak out. When you see something that is not right, you must say something. You must do something. Democracy is not a state. It is an act, and each generation must do its part to help build what we call the beloved community, a nation and world society at peace with itself. Ordinary people with extraordinary vision can redeem the soul of America by getting in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. Voting and participating in the democratic process are key. The vote is the most powerful nonviolent change agent you have in a democratic society. You must use it because it is not guaranteed. You can lose it. You must also study and learn the lessons of history because humanity has been involved in this soul-wrenching existential struggle for a very long time. People on every continent have stood in your shoes through decades and centuries before you. The truth does not change, and that is why the answers worked out long ago can help you find solutions to the challenges of our time. Continue to build union between movements stretching across the globe, because we must put away our willingness to profit from the exploitation of others. Though I may not be here with you, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe. In my life, I have done all I can to demonstrate that the way of peace, the way of love and nonviolence, is the more excellent way. Now it is your turn to let freedom ring. When historians pick up their pens to write the story of the 21st century, let them say that it was your generation who laid down the heavy burdens of hate at last, and that peace finally triumphed over violence, aggression, and war. So I say to you, walk with the wind, brothers and sisters, and let the spirit of peace and the power of everlasting love be your guide. Those last two paragraphs are super powerful, and they go with today's scripture. In your end days, will you honestly be able to answer and say, though I may not be here with you, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe? And can you honestly say, will you honestly be able to say, in my life, I have done all I can to demonstrate that the way of peace, the way of love and nonviolence, is the more excellent way? From the members of the Namekagon UCC in Earl, may you have a safe and blessed week. Tune in next Sunday at 10:30 a.m. for another message. And when we begin to meet in person for worship again, whenever that will be, I hope you'll consider visiting the United Church of Christ, a just world for all.